It seems that summoning ambassadors for a scolding somehow won't be enough. After last week's unprecedented wave of Russian drones that landed in Poland, Romania's turn to scramble fighter jets and call in Kremlin's envoy. The UK has done the same as Russia fills Ukraine's skies with ever-increasing unmanned devices. We'll ask why and whether indeed Vladimir Putin is testing frontline NATO states who till now thought that the United States firmly had their backs. The U.S., whose president can't bring himself to categorically condemn Russian aggression, even after a phone call with a new Polish counterpart who's a conservative fellow traveler. Speaking of fellow travelers, there's the support of Vice President J.D. Vance for a German far right that's again made historic inroads in Sunday regional elections, and the like-minded Elon Musk, who spoke by video link to London's largest far-right rally in decades, caught between Russia's offensive and the illiberal winds blowing from across the Atlantic. What can cash-strapped Europeans do on their own to defend their own continent? Today in the France 24 debate, we're asking if Europe can deter Russia and its drones. With us from Kyiv, France 24 correspondent Gulliver Cragg. Thanks for joining us. Joining us as well, former French ambassador to Moscow, Claude Blanchemaison. You've just published memoirs, fragments of an adventurous road. How would you say it?
Yes, of course.
Wasn't a rocky road at times.
No, but adventurous. Yes.
Okay, that's for sure. Thanks. Thank you for being with us. That book published in French. Samantha de Bender, an associate fellow for the Russia and Eurasia program at the think tank Chatham House. Good to see you.
Good evening.
And former Polish diplomat Bartosz Gordecki, security analyst at the Sobiecki Institute think tank. Welcome to the show.
Gentlemen, thank you very much for having me here in France 24.
On the go, by the way, you can listen to the show wherever podcasts are streamed. Yeah, after the summoning of the Russian ambassador to Romania, which came the same day as an EU meeting on further sanctions against Moscow, those EU nations perhaps feeling the squeeze from Washington. The U.S. wants the Europeans to buy American oil. Washington, which is far away from the anxiety felt in former Soviet bloc states. Eliza Herbert has more.
When NATO sent troops to shoot down drones in Poland's airspace last week, it was the first time its warplanes had directly engaged with Russian weaponry since World War II. Poland's foreign minister has told The Guardian the drones were not loaded with explosives. He believes the Kremlin was simply testing NATO's responsiveness.
Interestingly, they were all duds, which suggests to me that Russia tried to test us without starting a war.
On Saturday, another breach of NATO airspace, a Russian drone detected in Romanian skies. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said the incursion could not be a mistake and that it was an obvious expansion of the war by Russia. Moscow has not claimed either incursion was intentional. It has, however, taken aim at NATO.
NATO is de facto involved in this war. NATO provides both indirect and direct support to the Kyiv regime. Therefore, we can say with absolute certainty that NATO is at war with Russia.
What is not certain is how much the Trump administration will continue supporting its NATO allies. When it comes to further sanctioning Russia, he says he is willing to, but he wants Europe to act as well.
Look, Europe is, they're my friends, but they're buying oil from Russia. So we can't be expected to be the only ones that are, you know, full bore.
Trump has yet to follow through on any of his repeated threats to impose tougher measures on Moscow. And alliance members have expressed uncertainty over his commitment to their defence in the incident of an actual attack.
Gulliver Cragg, there's more with the Kremlin stating that the drone that fell Saturday in Romania was a Ukrainian provocation. What's the reaction where you are?
I think that they wanted to portray, at least to one part of their audience, the whole thing, including the 19 or 20 drones that crossed into Polish airspace as a Ukrainian provocation as well. Certainly they tried that, and they appear to have had a lot of bots lined up, communicating, posting, including in Polish, words to that effect. I don't think it worked as well as they perhaps hoped, because there was very, very swift condemnation and great clarity, including from Karol Nawrocki, the Polish president, who I think they might have thought might be a bit more ambiguous about that, that nobody should believe that kind of stuff, and that there's ample evidence from the intelligence services of all the countries, from the nature of the drones that fell on the ground, as we've been learning from analysts in the subsequent days, also from the fact that some of the drones weren't even equipped to fly over Ukrainian airspace. And so I think that they're always trying to say that things are Ukrainian provocations. And it seems to me from where I'm sitting that nobody believes them, but I think I'm probably being a bit misguided by the bubble I live in. There are probably some people that believe in them, and that's why they keep on pushing these sort of twin narratives. On the one hand side, they're clearly trying to scare Europeans, the response. On the other hand side, they're trying to convince certain people that the Ukrainians are engaging in extremely extravagant and outlandish acts of provocation.
Bartosz Kordetsky, how do you explain those 19 drones, or 20, as Gulliver says, that landed between the hours of midnight and 6:30 a.m. last Wednesday?
Well, I would start maybe a little bit from in the introduction, that to us, Russia is intensifying hybrid operation against NATO. That's with certain. Using drone as an instrument of pressure and regional destabilization. And that was happening in Poland 5 days ago. The drone incidents in Poland and Romania constitute as a test of the resilience of NATO, Eastern flank states, and the credibility of allies as a whole. So that's a kind of test of being together, being in NATO, and checking and like double check the NATO response on that. I would also add, which is very important, that we right now facing the Zapad 2025 military exercise. And they should be perceived not only as a military drills, but also as an element of psychological propaganda operation. And obviously Russia, as our colleague said, the aim of sending these drones to Romania and Poland was obvious to us, that they will start to, in one hand, put the pressure on NATO member state, but they will blame Ukraine for that, because that's the easy way to do that. And that's the disinformation which we have to together fight on United Nations Assembly and in mass media.
Yeah, it's ahead of next week's opening of the United Nations General Assembly. And you just referenced it this Monday, Russia inviting the international press in to watch joint military exercises with Belarus that include Iskander ballistic missiles. But it's the low-budget Gerbera drone that's got everyone on edge, those that landed last Wednesday inside of Poland. And, I mean, Claude Blanchemaison, there was this talk of NATO's first reaction was, we responded firmly and forcefully, cooperation with AWACS, F-16s, F-35s, but this is for low-budget drones. Is it actually a failure of NATO, the fact that they don't have what it takes to counter what were dummies, drones that weren't even equipped with weaponry?
Well, first of all, I would say that the probability that Putin is trying to test the reaction of Poland, of Romania, and of NATO is very high probability. Well, it's not absolutely certain, but I would say it is almost certain. And especially because part of those drones were flying in Poland over the zone through which the military aid coming from Western countries are going through. So maybe they want to know more about it, what kind of military equipment the West is providing, is going to provide.
Some of it may be surveillance.
Yes, because probably they don't have the same quality of the satellites that the Americans have to see what's happening in Poland. So that's maybe an explanation. But those drones in that case would be exploratory drones, in fact, to see what's happening in this area of Poland. I don't think those drones were meant to strike on Poland. But it's also, they say to Polish government, we can do that, so we could one day, we could strike also. I mean, that's a real threat for Polish government. And that's also a dividing issue maybe between the president and Donald Tusk, but in fact it was not, because they agree on this issue that it was a threat coming from Russia and it has to be addressed by NATO.
Samantha de Bendern, you heard a moment ago Bartosz Grodzicki there talking about how the motivation here is political and pointing to the fact that we are headed to what's called UN Week next week. Is that what this is all about when you look at the timing?
I think the timing is, I'm not quite sure that the timing is really about UN Week. I think it was more about showing a demonstration of force preceding the Zapad exercises, which started on Friday. These are the exercises that take every 4 years, in which Russia and this year Belarus also simulate war games and usually an attack either on a Western country or from a Western country. I see it more in that context. I see it more as provocation. I find it very interesting, the timing interesting, days after the Polish president visited Donald Trump in Washington, and both men emphasized their strong friendship and their strong ideological ties. So I see it more as a sort of what would the expression
be? Thumbing his nose at the United States?
Yeah, thumbing his nose at the United States, saying, look what I can do. And as for whether or not it was an accident, I don't accept that theory at all. One drone could get lost. 19 drones is a lot more worrying. And then there's an interesting argument, because either it was a deliberate attack or it was an accident. In either case, it shows how dangerous it is to be to have a border with Ukraine, which is under Russian attack, and it really increases the need for a sky shield, possibly not only on NATO's eastern flank, but over parts of Ukraine, a sky shield which is being called for by many voices as a petition right now in France that has gained many signatures.
Sky shield, you mean a no-fly zone?
A no-fly zone and a protection of the skies. So if Russian drones are so unpredictable that they can get scrambled or they just get lost and 19 of them cross the border into a NATO country, then NATO needs to defend itself by extending a defense over Ukrainian sky. The argument is very clear. The argument has actually been given to us by the Russians to say, well, they got lost. Fine, they got lost. You're unreliable. We need to protect ourselves. So I think it's great that they reacted in that way.
All right. A no-fly zone with or without the United States, though. Donald Trump's initial reaction last Wednesday was an ambiguous post on Truth Social where he stated, here we go. And that was followed by statements that chastised in equal measure Russians and Ukrainians for refusing direct talks. Poland's prime minister, who without mentioning Trump, pushed back.
We don't think Russia is behind this provocation. We know it. However, I also understand that for all those who would like some kind of normalization, stabilization, some kind of policy of understanding with Russia, this situation is very uncomfortable. Because if what happened in the Polish skies on the night of September 10th is happening, it's hard to pretend that nothing happened. I hope that none of our allies will pretend that nothing happened, because it did happen.
So, Bartosz Grodzicki, you heard there's a petition here doing the rounds calling for this sky shield, this no-fly zone here in France. Realistically, what are the chances?
The chances of introducing the restriction on the skies and on flies
Over Ukraine.
over Ukraine. You mean that? I'm sorry, because I didn't get the question properly.
What are the chances of there being a no-fly zone?
Well, the government introduced the no-fly zone after this incident, after this attack on Polish airspace, and right now, for this moment, we are operating normally, as I can tell. But it is also a possibility because, like, if we introduce that, and the fly zone, as far as I remember, was the restriction was introduced for 2 hours, that's a strong signal that it can be extended. And that was said that we're in the middle of Zapad right now, and it is worth to say that during the Zapad, this Zapad, Russia invite military attaches from US, China, Turkey, and Iran. So showing this kind of openness and transparency to this exercise, and tell, like, look, we're so transparent that you can see what is going on Zapad. But 2021, I would like to remind that Zapad 21 was an introduction to the migration crisis and escalation of war in Ukraine. So, in my opinion, right now, all the plans, all possibilities should be on the table, and should be, and they should be recognized as possibilities, as a possibility plans, include the restriction on flights over Poland. Right now, we do not have to escalate. The sky is open, but like I said, the plan should be on the table.
Gulliver Craig, are the Poles correct in being jittery to that extent? They're saying this could be a dress rehearsal for something bigger.
Well, a lot of people are making that comparison with 2021 and the fact that after that, that's when Russia launched its full-scale invasion of Ukraine. In Ukraine, certainly the general mood is that the Europeans should be more worried than they are, and that has been the case for months. I mean, everyone in Ukraine always says that Russia is a threat to Europe and Europeans need to realize. And so, in a sense, this bigger incursion than before into Polish airspace is being greeted with a degree of hope by Ukrainians, thinking maybe this will finally make them realize, because one of the things that they surely have realized in very, very practical terms is that they do not have the wherewithal to shoot down hundreds of Russian drones, because they use planes. Their operation to down those drones was hugely expensive compared to the drones themselves. They only shot down 4 of them because they couldn't manage to shoot down the others, and luckily they didn't have warheads and they just ended up flying as far as they could before crashing. Or is it because they took a decision that it wasn't worth spending the money of the hugely expensive missiles that they have on these planes in order to shoot drones that they had by that point realized were going to be harmless, just going to crash anyway? We don't know. But either way, it shows that they can't cope if they had really as many drones, or even 1/4 as many drones as there are in Ukrainian airspace on a night of a massive attack. And so the Ukrainians are saying, well, they need to realize they really need to do something, and we can help them here, and hopefully we can get something back from them in return. So now they're all talking about how the Ukrainians can help the Poles to shoot down drones next time they fly into Polish airspace without spending millions of dollars on it, but in return hoping the Poles will finally commit to shooting down some drones, or perhaps using their Patriot air defense systems to shoot down missiles and rockets that are in the airspace of Western Ukraine within range of Polish cities.
So just to follow up on that, Gulliver, what's your reaction when France releases images of 3 Rafale fighter jets dispatched to Poland to help patrol the skies?
Well, everyone in Ukraine is saying that what we've learned from this is that it's not jets that are needed. It's interceptor drones, Stinger systems, cheaper systems, because you can't shoot down drones that cost, you know, a few tens of thousands of dollars, and there are hundreds of them, by scrambling jets. It's just too expensive.
Ukraine's also got drones, by the way. A large attack with at least 361 drones targeting Russia Sunday, sparking a brief fire at the Kirishi oil refinery complex in Russia's northwest. Something we haven't talked about yet, Ambassador Blanche Maison, is this part of what it's about, that Is Ukraine denting Russia's capacity right now?
Yes, I think now Ukraine has the capacity of hitting a refinery and also places where oil is stocked, and they are very successful in that, because I think approximately one-third of the capacity of refinery of Russia has been completely destroyed. So it's very effective, in fact, and the lack of oil in some places in Russia, the prices are higher also, so it hits really Russia, and I think it's very effective, which means that in fact Ukraine, on this respect, is able to arm Russia in a very effective way, not on the front, but really on the Russian soil, in the heart of Russia.
And yet we see as well that the Russians now have ramped up their own drone production. And it's a question of who can outlast who. And
yes, of course, but I think they also see that reaction of Trump as usually very ambiguous, because Trump is saying, well, I am not happy with what the Russians are doing. I'm not happy at all with those strikes, but with drones going over Poland and over Romania. But then he say, well, I will take maybe some economic sanction, but he put yesterday two conditions, provided that the European don't buy any more of the Russian oil and gas, and provided they put very high sanction, custom duty sanction against India and against China, 100% custom duties, which is, of course, completely impossible. I mean, how can we cut off all our economic links with India and with China?
Yeah, and for what is true in what Donald Trump said is that Europeans are still buying Russian oil, some of it directly, for the third month running the Kria think tank, noting a downturn in Russia's oil exports. And while the EU's share of imported Russian hydrocarbons has gone from 23% to 2% of its total needs, that same study here points to the fact that now the biggest buyers, this is last month's statistics, Samantha De Bendern, China, okay, we know that, India, and Turkey. And what is being said is that a lot of the oil that's going as crude to India and Turkey is coming here as refined products. So directly or indirectly, Europe's still buying Russian oil.
Yes, one of the big problems is not only oil, but LNG, liquid natural gas, because many European countries, France included, have actually increased some of their liquid natural gas imports since the beginning of the war. Other countries like Lithuania, Estonia and Latvia have completely stopped importing liquid natural gas from Russia at considerable inflationary expense to their own populations, but they understand how important it is to cut off this source of revenue. Regarding oil.
Do you agree with the ambassador that for the Europeans it's a difficult spot when Donald Trump pressures the Europeans to follow his sanctions on China and India?
Well, I would first of all like to say that Donald Trump has delayed imposing tariffs on China, and that is the big problem. Donald Trump has imposed tariffs on India. The result has been that India is now exporting a lot of its Russian oil to China for China to then continue exporting. So, yes, how much I hate to say this, Donald Trump does have a point when he says that the Europeans have to really stop buying Russian oil and gas. But what Donald Trump should also do is decide that maybe if he's so interested in this, he should impose the duties he was going to impose on Chinese oil and gas products or any other sanctions he was going to impose on China, not just unilaterally on India. And maybe Donald Trump should also not have lifted sanctions from the Belarusian air carrier Belavia, allowing Belavia now to purchase aviation components, which no one needs to be too much of a conspiracy theorists to imagine the Belarusians will then be able to sell on to the Russians, whose civilian fleet is, one third of its civilian fleet is grounded because they can't get the components to maintain civilian planes. So Donald Trump should also perhaps, you know, correct some of his inconsistencies if he's going to be imposing such things on Europe.
NATO is still heavily dependent on the United States. Ukraine also dependent on U.S. Know-how. There was a brief worldwide outage to Elon Musk's low-orbit Starlink system overnight, enough to give the jitters to Ukrainians, a nation heavily reliant on Starlink, Gulliver Craig. I saw on social media some wondering aloud whether this was a conspiracy.
You can always find people in Ukraine wondering aloud whether something is a conspiracy. But when I've spoken to soldiers recently about the risks of them losing Starlink, they have always reassured me by saying we've got a backup plan. You know, they can't tell you in great detail exactly what it is or how it works, but I think they've got several backup plans by now because they know that risk exists.
Bartosz Grodzicki, it's the question of with the U.S. reluctant to take on Russia, how vulnerable are Europeans?
Well, in one hand, you can never say that you're 100% ready on the conflict. But the other one, well, we're living in from ages, from pretty much World War II, in a relatively peaceful time in Europe, I would say. So the only army we have, which have experience to fight, experience from war, is the Ukrainian army. And that was mentioned before. If you want to shoot drones, you need to take the experience from military who's in the middle of the war, heavy war. I remember 2022. That was the summertime when I talked to Yevgeny Yenin. Yevgeny Yenin died in a helicopter crash in January 2023. And in the middle of 2023, he said, that was also mentioned before, that they use the anti-aircraft missiles to shut down drones. Right now, they don't do it anymore because, like it was also mentioned before, it's too expensive. So they have so good experience from battlefield when the U.S. Army, NATO army, should learn from. And we as well, as a Poland, we should take that experience and use that to prepare us and NATO as a whole for our defense system, anti-drone system, and prepare ourselves based on that experience on potential conflict, but also to fight those provocation which we faced 5 days ago in Poland and 3 days ago in Romania. This experience is crucial right now, and like I said, this is the only army who are on a battlefield. This is not a training, this is a real world, this is a real fight. And this is the experience which we should get and learn from it.
And the question then is how much public opinion in Western democracies follow backup Ukraine? We talked about Starlink. Its owner made headlines over the weekend in another precinct. Elon Musk joining the big far-right rally in London, where crowds exceeded expectations. Musk weighed in on UK politics just days before Donald Trump travels there for a state visit.
I really think there's got to be a change of government in Britain. We don't have another 4 years or whatever the next election is. It's too long. Something's got to be done. There's got to be a dissolution of parliament and a new vote.
Samantha Benton, I know that he's no longer in the Trump administration, Elon Musk, but here he's calling for a snap election in Britain, or change of government were his words. He's still the guy who can press on the button of Starlink and who controls and who's got huge sway in Silicon Valley.
Yeah, this is, apart from the fact that it's absolutely outrageous that somebody from outside the UK should interfere in British politics like that, it also shows the shifting dynamics in world politics where money is beginning to control the world.
Is it foreign meddling when he's a private citizen, but he's the world's richest man?
Yes, it is. Because today, the world has changed. Today, people like him can shape public opinion and can sway governments. We saw what happened in Germany this weekend when AfD, the German far-right party, which is also supported by Elon Musk, made enormous headways in West Rhine-Westphalia. When you go back to talking about the UK, if you go back to the whole Brexit issue, Brexit had funding from a number of foreign entities, foreign people, including the Russians, by the way. So this is, politics have changed. Politics and money are more intertwined than ever. There's a new international oligarchy, which, and some very interesting people have written about it. I'd recommend a book by Anne Applebaum called Autocracy Inc., which talks about how autocrats and private companies, very, very rich people, are managing to sway the world because they control the tools of information. Just another thing about
this. Is it working? Are they swaying?
Yes, it is working.
In the UK, they're swaying?
It is working, and governments are not doing enough to fight back. Now, and it's very difficult for governments to fight back. They do not have the financial resources that these people have at their disposal. And they do not have the will, I don't think, because it's very difficult for a government to fight back. A government cannot manipulate information, certainly not in a democracy. These people have no qualms about manipulating information. And talking about manipulating information, a lot of noise has been made about the 100,000 plus people who were attending the rally in London. It is a lot of people. The last Brexit, anti-Brexit rally I went to in London in 2019 had 700,000 people attending it, but very few people spoke about it on the news because you didn't have very rich people interested in spreading this information. So let's also put things into perspective here.
All right. It was, you mentioned it there, in Germany's most populous region, North Rhine-Westphalia, Sunday elections, which will probably put the Conservatives back in power. They finished tops there. But the far right nearly tripled its score to just under 15% of the vote. And the pattern is the same. And we're wondering what's going to happen here in France, obviously, either with snap parliamentary elections or certainly with the presidential poll in 2027. Do you agree with Samantha de Bendern that it is working? This chipping away at public opinion?
Of course, in a way, but we don't know. To answer your question on France, I mean, we won't know what's going to happen in France, basically, because we don't know how the new prime minister will manage to work out a budget for next year, which is his task for the time being. And maybe he will succeed. We don't know. But anyway, the president said he doesn't want to have new parliamentary election, of course, except if there is no other way.
If a representative of the pro-Putin far right wins the presidential elections, and by the way, Marine Le Pen is the favorite right now, as if the election were held tomorrow, which it's not.
So yes, because the president wants also to go.
What would that mean for Ukraine?
I don't know, because I think that Marine Le Pen in the past had been in good relation with Vladimir Putin, and there has been some financial relations between Russia and her party in France. Now they deny anything. They said it's not the case anymore. I doubt about that, but I doubt more that Marine Le Pen would be elected if there was an election in a few years, at a normal time in 27.
And right now we have a situation where these leaders who are Bartosz Grodzki backing Ukraine, Chancellor Merz of Germany, President Macron of France, Keir Starmer, the Prime Minister of Britain, who are underperforming domestically. So again, where does that leave this almighty showdown between Europe in the middle, between Russia and the US?
Well, this is a very good question, and I bet no one knows the proper answer. Because with the UK, we have Boris Johnson government and the Rishi Sunak government, and they support Ukraine, and they give and show the support from the beginning of the war. Olaf Scholz government was a little bit late, but still, Germany at the end showed the support to Ukraine. The AfD, actually, The official agenda is it's very pro-Russian. So we'll see what's going to happen. It's a local election, but it will probably be followed. France, well, President Macron and his position about war in Ukraine is very clear, and there's no doubt about it. Well, the nationalist in France, Marie Le Pen, well, like you have mentioned, she had close ties to Putin, but we don't know what's happened here and now. Well, with Eastern Europe and Poland, which I represent, well, both sides of the political scene, President Trzaskowski, the mayor of Warsaw, and President Nawrocki, who won the election, they have the same absolutely agenda on the war on Ukraine. We have no doubt at the beginning that this is the war about the sovereignty, not only Ukraine, but Europe as well. So we have this strong awareness of this tough neighborhood with Russia, and the war in Ukraine, in which side of the political scene in Poland you look at, is pretty much the same. We align with that. And you have mentioned that before. After the drone incident, the presidential palace and the government, they sat together on the National Security Council, and they discussed what we should do next and how to cooperate on security matters, which is great.
But let me ask you about President. Let me ask you about President Nawrocki, because he's a newcomer to politics. He is somebody who will be meeting on Tuesday with the German chancellor. When it comes to his dealings with Donald Trump, his party, the Peace, which was very close to Donald Trump in his first term, people hoping here in Europe that he would have Donald Trump's ear. It doesn't seem to be the case so far. What should he do in his dealings with Trump?
Well, with Donald Trump, what you can say is he has his own agenda, and he won with this agenda, which is America first. So the first thing for Donald Trump is definitely America. But he has close ties with some of the leaders in Europe, and President Nawrocki is one of them. Let me remind you that he showed his political support before the election to Karol Nawrocki, and he shows and perceived a symbolic and strategic backing during the election campaign. They also have some kind of ideological convergence. The both leaders are pretty much, they have conservative worldwide worldview, stressing the sovereignty, Christian values, skepticism towards EU federalization, and opposition to some kind of globalist agendas. But what is important to us, and what was heard in Warsaw as well after the visit of President Nawrocki in White House, that there was some kind of security and military commitments made by Donald Trump. He promised us, and he's like said that out loud, that the American troops would remain in Poland, which means that strengthened NATO, and potentially even increase their presence if we requested it. So that's a strong signal, I would say, and I will read that as well, that there is some kind of geopolitical importance amid Russian aggression in Poland right now. And that might be President Nawrocki might be the one who will have this special relation with Donald Trump, and the other Western countries might use that as well. Plus, like you have mentioned before, President Nawrocki is going to Germany. He's already there, and he's going to talk to Chancellor Merz. So that's a good step towards with our Poland-German relations. And I hope, and I'm sure of it, the security matters will be on the top of the agenda.
So Gulliver Cragg, would you be rooting, if you're trying to get Donald Trump's ear, would you be rooting more for President Nawrocki of Poland or for the King of England, who's going to be welcoming Donald Trump for that state visit that begins Tuesday?
Cool role, I think. I mean, I think there's a very important thing to consider about this, which is that this could have played out differently. I think it's plausible that Karol Nawrocki could have waited after this Russian drone incursion into Polish airspace to see what Donald Trump would say. He could have been a bit more ambiguous, saying we need to work out what exactly happened. He did not do that. He came straight out saying this is an act of aggression, don't believe their lies, saying it's anything else, convened the National Security Council and showed unity with Donald Tusk's government. At the moment, you've got rivals, absolute arch rivals, holding the presidency and the prime minister's office in Poland. I'm sure that the Polish election result, the presidential election in June this year, was the result that Putin wanted because it divides Poland. And I think that this wasn't just a military test and a test for NATO. It was a test of Polish politics by Vladimir Putin, knowing that Karol Nawrocki is very keen on developing his relationship with Donald Trump, considers himself a fan of Donald Trump, that Putin maybe was hoping that he could see some what would be, I think, weakness on the part of Poland in terms of Nawrocki's desire to flatter Trump. And Trump, as we know, still kind of saying that he's not sure, it might have been a mistake, and making this completely, utterly unintelligible post on his Truth Social that day.
So in the end, President Nawrocki sided squarely as both Bartosz and
political test, I think.
And Gulliver said they were unambiguous. Samantha De Bendern.
Yeah, he sided squarely with his country. And so because he's not a nationalist for nothing. This is the irony of when we talk about the far right movement in Europe. It is not a homogenous bloc. You have some far right or very, very, very right-wing governments like Giorgio Meloni in Italy, who are very clearly Atlanticist and who understand the Russian threat. Then you have the Poles also, who of course understand the Russian threat. They have an ideological similarity with Donald Trump when it comes to, you know, Poland first. Poland is not part of the coalition of the willing of those who would be prepared to send troops to Ukraine because they want to keep them at home, because they need to defend their own country. They have actually sent 40,000 men to the Belarusian, the Polish-Belarusian border, both as a response to the drone attack and also because of the Zapad exercises. Then you have the far right in Germany, which is very close to Putin. A very interesting example would be the far right in Estonia. Now, there were rumors a year and a half ago that the far right anti-Russian party in Estonia had received financing and electoral guidance from the Wagner Group. Now, this seems completely preposterous. An article came out in Politico. I actually met the Estonian researcher who did all the OSINT, the open source intelligence research, to discover this. And he had found the actual evidence. He got a lot of flack after that. And he explained to me, well, what the Russians want to do, they want to divide us. If it means supporting anti-Russian parties to divide the European Union amongst itself or to divide countries within themselves, they will do it. Because the more divided we are, the weaker we are. The more together we are, the stronger we are. That is the reality of Russian interference in European politics.
Ambassador Blanche-Maison?
Well, I agree completely with that. And to come back to Poland, I think the Polish people, for historical reason, are very suspicious about the attitude of Russia, of course. And this war in Ukraine has confirmed them. I mean, whoever they are and whatever party it is in Poland. So, I mean, and that's why it was decided to reinforce the army, to have probably today the first army in Europe, in fact. I think in Poland would be very difficult to take a comprehensive attitude towards Kremlin. But it could happen with some far-right parties in other countries in Europe.
A brief final word, Gulliver Cragg?
Well, I just wanted to point out that it's documented and proven, I think, that in the 2010s, the Party of Regions, pro-Russian Viktor Yanukovych's party in Ukraine, presumably in coordination with Russia, was funding the Ukrainian nationalist Svoboda Party, supposedly ideologically absolutely anathema to Viktor Yanukovych's Party of Regions. For that reason, to divide the country, to boost forces that would be seen as unpalatable in Western Europe, it's something that I think that they've been doing I think they started longer ago than that. There are probably examples you can find way back in the past. It's a typical Russian playbook to fund parties that will be well opposed to them, but they're going to cause problems in the countries that they're in.
divide and conquer. Gulliver Cragg, many thanks for joining us from Kyiv. I want to thank Bartosz Grodzicki for being with us from Warsaw, Claude Blanche-Maison, Samantha de Bendern.
Thank you
for being with us here in the France 24 debate.
Thank you.